Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming. Welcome to the National Press Club and another NPC Morning Newsmaker. My name is Peter Hickman. I'm a former USI Foreign Service officer. Never stationed in our speaker's country, though. Wasn't fortunate enough, Omar. Now a freelance writer, editor, and a media consultant, and member and past vice chairman of the club's newsmaker committee. And before introducing this morning's newsmakers, I want to make the usual announcements. This newsmaker is being recorded by the club, and a sound file will be available for the club members through the website at press.org, and others can purchase a copy of a CD, I guess, from the Broadcast Operations Center right here. Please turn off any cell phones and blackberries and blueberries and whatever, bananas. There are other newsmakers coming up, and they're upstairs, not down here. You're welcome to come to some of those. And there's some material here related to this morning's newsmaker, and I think you already have some of that. So our newsmakers, as you know, are Mr. Omar Jamal, Executive Director of the Somali Justice Advocacy Center in Minneapolis, on my immediate left, and his colleague, and forgive me, and you're also with the visitor. And on his way, we are told, Ambassador Robert Oakley, who was, among quite a few other things, in a long and distinguished diplomatic career, along with his wife, who was also an ambassador to several countries, Phyllis. He was twice U.S. Special Envoy to Somalia. And Omar, and you know, welcome, and Ambassador Oakley, when you get here, we'll welcome you. And I want to thank Mr. Jamal for suggesting and helping arrange this newsmaker. So our speaker's topic, as you know, is the Somali pirate situation, and specifically the targeting of young Somali immigrants in the U.S. and the Minneapolis area where our speakers are stationed, or may live, is said to be housed the largest Somali community in the U.S. Targeting of the young Somali men by terrorist groups in Somalia, a country which has had no effective government for a number of years now. And the picture seems to be that these young men are taken to Somalia by whatever groups do it, where they sort of blend into the populace and then thought to become involved in piracy. And the Somali Justice Advocacy Center thinks this piracy results from, among other things, the lack of law and order in Somalia and a high level of al-Qaeda influence in a country which, as was said, has no effective government. So, after our newsmakers talk, they will take your questions, and please let them know your name and affiliation when you ask them and to whom your questions is directed. And also, when you do have a question, you should give me a signal of some sort. I'll call on you in turn, and as many of you as time permits. And finally, if you haven't already done so, as you leave, please add your name to the sign-in sheet outside. Thank you very much. Mr. Jamal?
Good morning. Well, I guess the issue on piracy, there's no better time than now to talk about it when one of the survivor of the four in New York just got indicted yesterday for 10 counts by Southern District of New York. So I think the timing is perfect. One thing that kind of made me thinking yesterday is I ran into a friend of mine somewhere in Virginia, and I asked him, and he asked me, how the hell do you survive under ever-evolving Somali political crisis? It is kind of every time it takes a new dimension. And how do you contain your sanity on this? We are an extension of that country. We are a product of the history of that region. How does one able to wake up in the morning and act like human being? My friend's response was Omar. He said, I discovered a secret to make me be a normal human being. And I said, what is that secret? And he said, I became an engaged Sufism, you know, engaged modern Sufi. He said, I practice Sufism, you know. Because of that, he said, I became one in nature. You know, if someone calls me and tells me in 6 seconds the world will come to an end, I still be able to contain the peace of mind in spite of that, he said. And I said, amazing, you know. And it was a classic example how my generation of the country, given the current situation, comes up with different means of psychological survivalism, as you put it. In back then in Europe, people in Germany, when the tribes of Germany used to invade Rome, and you have Napoleon Bonaparte invading countries, and you have the height of enlightenment. I think philosophers and average individuals on the street with the critical thinking, if not able to understand, they would go crazy. You know, Nietzsche lost his mind. One time he said, "God is dead. There's no way we're going to be able to reason or make any sense out of the physical surrounding us here. Therefore, God must be dead." The issue of biasy, that in a nutshell actually is a feeling that we carry every day when we wake up in the morning. It's like people torn apart. I'm here and I'm not here. I'm there, I'm not there. You know, what's going on here? You know, when I came into Memphis in 1997, I started tutoring math at Booker T. Washington High School in Memphis. And one of the first thing that I struck in my mind was that the disparity between haves and have-nots in downtown Memphis. African Americans over there used to call white flight. You know, they were living out of the cities in the suburbs, German town, what have you. And think of this, a new guy doesn't know what this country is all about. I said, gee, you know, a country is having a color problem, you know, where to me color doesn't mean anything at all. So as I'm concerned, the pigment of the person's skin doesn't reflect who the person is. The person is a product of a culture. To me, to get along with African American is as difficult as it is to get along with a white Caucasian American. They're both the same because they're both the product of this culture and product of different and alien culture, if you would like to have it that way. The Somali crisis have many combination of factors. Why Somali is the way it is today? It has millions of reasons why. But the two primary main reasons that have the most effect on it is the collapse of the state in 1991, complete disintegration of any thinkable institution in the country is gone. And the other reason is, to my understanding, an ill-advised Western policies towards the country. The current U.S. policy in place towards Somalia has been thus far been a disaster. The abandonment of the Wilsonian idealism, you know, Wilsonian doctrine, rather than became isolated. Because if a country would like to have any level, however minimum it is, on influence of any country, this time U.S., one must exert oneself on the ground to have any level of influence. After the collapse, we have the era of warlordism. You know, quite a time of period where the country was completely pillaged, cut into pieces in the fiefdoms, each part run by a warlord. The trick is then, under each warlord, given a clan politics, emerged a semi-weak Islamic courts with the blessing of the warlord. Warlord felt it, the courts give them some sense of legitimacy because they are practicing minimum services to the community, marriage contracts, family conflict resolutions, what have you. So having a warlord under which a court is practicing, the warlord felt, you know, his ego became a little bit bigger. You know, and each warlord happened to have under each court. And we have to keep in mind, each of these different Islamic courts align with a different warlord, because one kind of courts cannot operate under a different clan warlord. They have to do it under the warlord that they align in a tribal Somali tradition. But the straw that broke the camel's back was when U.S. intelligence started giving the warlords cash, a rendition process, to capture individuals of interest for interrogation in the East African Terrorism Task Force based in Djibouti. They formed an organization, you know, Restoration of Peace and anti-terrorism groups, what have you. And I believe, if my memory doesn't fail me, Mr. Goss, and former CIA intelligence head, flew himself in a helicopter to Mogadishu City with a sack of US dollars, giving to the warlords, giving them names and photos. They need this guy. Bring him to Kenya, or send him to Djibouti for interrogation, and we'll send him back. Then out of fear, those different courts came and unified. And to the surprise of everybody, they kicked the warlords out of the capital in 2006. That was the turning point of the Somali politics. Now we have a powerful Islamicist in the hands of the Somali capital. And do not make a mistake, the influence of foreign extremists wasn't new to the country at that time. We had some of them involved in a Black Hawk Down in 1992 when U.S. invaded there. Osama bin Laden was very interested in that country. And if I were him, I would be. You have a vast territory without any law and order. A free country. There's no government. So the involvement of those groups didn't start at the time. It predated that, went way back in 1992. Actually, when the U.S. captain was captured, his helicopter was shut down, he was taken hostage. Oakley was there at the time, and retired General Jonathan Howe. Those who captured him asked the U.S. diplomats that they will only release him in exchange of Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman in New York. Where would that came from? You know, the guy's an Egyptian. Because of foreign individuals involved in this process, my influence, what we should ask and what we should not ask. So that instant of Islamicism taking over the country became a turning point. Ethiopian intervention down the road somewhat slowed down the momentum of the radicalism, but at the same time increased, in a sense, by giving the radical groups one more layer of platform, which is a nationalism platform. That now we have a country under occupation by a foreign Christian archaic enemy in Somalia. Ethiopian troops are the capital. So I don't care whether you're secular, whether you're fanatic, who the hell you are, we need to liberate these infidels out of the Somalia. And that was a extra tool for the Islamist group to lobby, which one of the main reasons why you have a lot of Somali kids being lured, you know, out of US, in Canada, in UK, to go and join Al-Shabaab. Amazing. Some people were saying maybe kids haven't left Minneapolis, or in that case from England, New Zealand, Australia, Scandinavians, and Canada. Well, one of the guys that left in my state has carried out suicide bombing. You know, Ahmed Shirwa killed himself along with 20 or 30 people. You know, very shy guy, went to Roosevelt High School. So it's amazing, what is it that he was told to drop the books, provide him a ticket and passport, and send him, and to convince him to blow himself up. I believe, was it Richard Nixon who said the art of diplomacy is to tell people to go to hell, and they will do it with a big smile on their face? You know, they will march to hell. So all of that was really an evolvement of Somali political crisis. The idea of clan politics failed to piece the country back together. The warlords miserably failed to do that. by not being able to comprise power and reinstitute the basic institution in the country. Islamicism, extremism, radicalism with a global agenda is attempting now to fill the empty vacuum. Now al-Shababs are within arm's reach of victory. The president of the transitional federal government right now, a former leader of Islamic Court Union, half-heartedly abusing the radical groups, not knowing what to do, not trusting the Western countries, you know, saying that, oh, these are after all infidels, you know, we belong here, but what are we supposed to do? Now hold up in the Somali presidential palace, not knowing what to do, surrounded by the Ugandese and Rwandan troops. The piracy issue is one of other outcome of the civil war. And the thing is, when the central government collapsed, the peripheral part of the country, the edges of the country itself, not only did they collapse, but also they became a different regional entity. You have a Somaliland claiming secessionism, Eddie. You have a Puntland region, administration and the president and parliament. So Puntland region is the region where mainly the piracy is taking place. And it all comes down to, I think, given the lack of, well, first of all, U.S. foreign policy is at this time confused. They don't know what to do. And meanwhile, there's internal debates between different departments in this country, thinking, you know, what the hell can we make of these people? Of course, the incident of Black Hawk Down, which was, by the way, a successful mission, and restore mission, hope in some, saved millions of lives. When Bush sent the U.S. Marines there to intervene, the famine and humanitarian crisis was amazingly successful, but it got overshadowed by an incident of war on October 3rd, 1993, I believe it was. That incident where 18 U.S. Marines were killed, two of them were dragged down the street of Mogadishu City. Boy, that incident became the center of decision-making at the legislatures and the U.S. decision-makers in this country towards Somalia. Every time Somalia is tabled, Black Hawk Down is the first thing they think about it. And what they did is a policy of non-engagement. Leave them alone. Let those guys kill each other off. U.S. came into the picture then when Osama bin Laden came into the picture. Osama said, hey, you know, I'm also shifting to different parts of this globe. You know, I'm interested there. So did U.S. become concerned. You have East African embassy bombing. You have a call American ship. Suicide bombing where 18 sailors were killed. You know, you have an attempt to shoot down an Israeli airplane out of Mombasa airport. All these were organized, carried out by a committed radical groups bases in Mogadishu City, not only in Mogadishu, in Somalia in general, in Kenya. That was an alarm to the U.S. National security reasons. But the question is, and still is, what do you do? For example, what do you do with the piracy? Who arrests them? This idea of universal jurisdiction, will it fly? You know, which country does have legally, in accordance with international law, can trial those people? You know, is it visible to trial a Somali citizen from a sovereign country in a Kenyan judicial system? When asked, actually, Mr. Morsi in New York, where would he be tried? I said United States, then Kenya, because I've been there, I've seen it, how Kenyan judicial system works. And to be frank, I don't have much honest trust in it. U.S. judicial system, yes, there's a separation of power. Now, I get a call last night, the mother of the guy in New York. One of the questions she asked me was, because he got indicted yesterday, is that do the judges in the United States do a kangaroo trial where they have the verdict already here given to them by Obama or head of the FBI. So they just, this is just a show. You know, I was telling her, no, nobody can tell a judge what to do. You know, a judge is an independent entity from the executive branch or any other branch of this government. He is completely different, unlike the perception of how judicial system works in Africa or what government is in Africa. It's different here. I was an hour or more on the phone with her, telling her, with other people, that no, that's not the case. It's not gonna. We've seen that in Somalia, where the regime held a lot of courts. People were executed by insulting the president, socialism, communism ideology, martial law. We've seen that, and when Somali come to think of government, that's what comes to their mind.
Omar, let me interrupt if I may. We're gonna have a time problem here. I mean, we'll take some questions.
Right. Okay. Okay. So the issue of piracy mainly is as a result of the collapse of the state, where it led to Europeans and Asian fishing companies literally going and fishing there illegally. Not only that, but them being toxic waste in the Somali coastline. One of the first paper published in Italy, Milan, Corriere della Sera, had a front page article talking about companies taking money to dump chemical waste in Somali coastline. In reaction to that, the fishers then started doing this. And to solve that, military solution is not the solution there. Another solution that was debated was an air bombardment. They just bombard them from the air. It's not going to fly. What you have is to start things from grassroots, bottom-up solution, where you empower the people. You know, you deal with them. We've been asking, one of the things that I always have fight with law enforcement agents here, that I don't want you to see me as a means to your end. I'm a genuine partnership with this issue. We need to work together. But if you came to me with a state of mind that I'm a means to his end or her end, be it an FBI or CIA, what have you, it's having collective backlash in the community. They say, you know, no, we've just, you know, nobody cares about us. We're all the same. You know, Osama bin Laden and Mr. Muhammad in the streets of Minneapolis are now exactly the same. Those guys all think it's us one. So that's therefore not a genuine working. I mean genuine working relationship between the two. With that, things will come with the question and answer period of time. With me also, I have Mr. Dr. Farah, who is a prominent member of the advocacy group based in Chicago, Illinois. He went back to Somalia. He just came back. We are dealing with now a parity issue, a Nigerian ship held in Somalia for 9 months. I was on the phone with the pirates last night, talking to them to release this ship. The family are begging, you know. The Nigerian government, I'm supposed to see the Nigerian ambassador in D.C., about this ship, Nigerian ship, 10 Nigerian citizens on board. He's been very instrumental in that. So with that,
all right, Mr. Orr, we are open for questions now. Please give your name and affiliation. And,
fine.
First question. Second question. Ken, you got them both.
I have a question on why.
What's your name and ID?
I'm sorry, I'm Ken Yates of Jefferson Waterman. Consulting firm here in Washington.
Which firm?
Jefferson Waterman.
Oh.
My question is, for the past decade now, there seems to have been the transitional government in varying forms, in varying iterations of it. Nothing seems to work. And can you give us a little background on your feelings on if it's not a matter of somebody coming from outside and imposing order and rationale to a new government. It's got to come from within. And why isn't that emerging? Why is it so hard? There's been consultations now in Kenya for years on this very issue. It's not working.
Good morning, gentlemen. My name is Abdullah Farah. Thank you for asking the questions. In Somali government, The problem, they have many problems on it. Lack of economic, lack of different faculty of people fighting with the government, with extremists and Muslim extremists, Al-Shabaab, Al-Qaeda, a lot of things difference. And I believe the government is very weak and they cannot do anything about it. The only people can do that, the international community must be invaded, Somali government. If you don't support institution of Somali government, becoming it's very important, it's becoming very dangerous. As a member of Somali Justice Advocates Center, thank you, Mr. Peter, and thank you, Mr. Jamal, as well as a community of problem. It's a lack of coordination between its U.S. government and Somalia, in its, as well as in Somalia. That is why we have piracy and terrorism. We lost this war in terror. And if left unchecked, the security of the whole region will be in danger. Quite sure, very dangerous.
That's an old age question. I think, was it Mark Twain? Someone said democracy is the best system. No, I mean, democracy is the worst system ever, except for all others. Do you impose solution from outside, or does it came from? I think the very natural reaction is the solution has to come from Somali people. That's where it starts, and that's where it must end. But Somali is not the Somali it used to be. You have a community where, in historical, before the invasion of the colonialism, British, Italy, and the French, clans living side by side, living peacefully. If there's a conflict, rape of a girl or killing or what have you, elders will come together. They have what's called hair. They have a traditional customary law to solve their internal conflicts. Within, in addition to Islamic Sharia, then you have the introduction of the Western governance. You have an elective representatives in Italy. We took the law of Mussolini came to Somalia. That was the experiment in Somalia from 1960 to 1969. Somalia introduced to the way of governing of a Western ideology. That collapsed. So now we are caught. We cannot go back way that the way we used to deal things, and we're not fully developed into a democratic civil a community where we are not a political community. So I think it's a combination of both. Somalia needs the help of the international community in order to clear their mess. But the solution lies within them. And we have an active, it goes without a question. You know, in Mogadishu City now, you have more than 400 foreigners fighting to try to topple the government, member of Al-Qaeda. And it's open. It's not secret. They're saying this openly. They give their allegiance to Osama bin Laden. They have a website. We cannot fight that. What are we going to do? We are trying to get the sense of the U.S. government and U.S. agencies saying that, listen, guys, this is very serious. We must do something. So I agree with you that we cannot export democracy. We cannot impose. The way you see things and the way your solution are may not be necessarily the way my solutions are. We're completely different. But we can, at the same time, empower and work in order to preserve the continuation of humanity, the continuation of sense of dignity, to help and solve crisis.
Can I ask a second question?
Sure.
That is, Somaliland has been around a while also, and it seems to be working there. There obviously, Somaliland has a similar cultural basis, and it seems to work. Puntland is coming sort of in between, I gather, although it's part of the state. It's a state, not a country. And it seems to be making an effort to make it work. Why is this so difficult in the South?
I do agree with you, Somaliland, and also in some level Puntland have achieved some level of stability. They held elections there, for God's sake. What went wrong in the South? The Mogadishu capital has been the seat for Somali central government for decades. That's where the ultimate power lies. If someone wants to govern the country, he better think about taking over Mogadishu City. Not Hargeisa, not Bosaso, but Mogadishu is the key. If you get Mogadishu City, any warlord, if they were able to seize the capital like the Islamists did, they would probably have been declared government. So Mogadishu City became a symbol of the power. That's where the regime stationed, ruled the country for a long time. And also it has a lot to do with why Somaliland the way it is, why Puntland the way it is. There's more than the eye can see. The nature of the fabric of the cultural society there, the differences of clan composition in that part of the country, the dominance of one over the others. There's a lot of different other elements that play a major role why things are the way they are in Somaliland and Puntland.
Dr. Farhan, do you want to add anything to this?
No problem.
All right, Ms. Chung, and then AP, and then this lady.
Thank you. My name is Grace Chung from Appalachia Newspapers. Earlier, you had mentioned that a military solution will not solve Somalia's problems, and that an isolationist policy by the United States government is equally ineffective. How do you foresee the U.S.'s role in creating a grassroots solution to this problem?
I think by engaging and partnering with the Somali community. I don't think so. My fear is Obama may get caught up with the mistakes in the past and repeat the same thing over again. We've seen the military didn't have any effects on the ground. Rather, it worsened the situation. Al-Qaeda or Al-Shabaab are more powerful they were before than they are now, after having Ethiopians invaded. And the U.S. reaction was a very selective air strike here and there by taking off one or other guy, by sending a missile out of a ship, navy on the sea, Indian Ocean, or in the Red Sea, or setting by jet over, dropping some smart bombs and leaving the country. Didn't do anything. What I mean is by empowering Somali people, by working, the common sense will eventually prevail. You got to reach out those who have cool heads in order to solve this problem. And I don't think so. This administration, or for that matter, the Americans, have any appetite now for having another military massive intervention in Africa, not to mention already problems in Iraq or Afghanistan, or even in Pakistan. If you look at it right now, Pakistan's almost, some people are already calling Pakistan a failed state, you know? So we it looks like the world is on flames.
Let's go to AP.
Quick follow-up on that question. You're talking about engagement in Somalia. I'm gathering the key will be funding. Is there a price? Is there an amount of money that the thought is that if the U.S. pours a certain amount of money into either economic development or whatever there, that would be the key? Or is there...
U.S. have pledged some funding to the different stages of the process in the country. So did the European Union, EU in Brussels, and also Arab League. The problem is, and has always been, a lack of an institution. You know, lack of accountability and transparency. You don't just write a check of $4 million to a warlord. Literally. So what is lacking seems to be there's not any institution in place in the country that would be accountable for that money, or even maybe transparency in the place. So where is this money going? You know, all of that. So any money given to TFGs or any part of the country always goes through UNDP, United Nations. It goes into account. And the funny thing it's all about is they use, if UNDP would like to, you know, release a cash or check to what have you, they go through hawalas. It's very ironic. You know, UNDP uses hawalas. Osama bin Laden uses hawalas. You know, everybody uses hawalas. It's very strange, you know, because both of them have no other means to move money from A to B. So Osama says, send that money through the hawalas. The guy up in UN building says, take money to that hawalas. So they all use the same process because there's no institution in place.
Well, and just one other. You mentioned a little bit about the Somali young men that are being recruited. Are you seeing an increase, a decrease? Is this still going on?
That's a very good question. To my shocking, you know, I was in my office, was it a month ago, and I was sent an email, and people came to my office with a petition. They had a petition, and they were expecting us to sign the petition. And what the petition said is not to coordinate with the FBI. The Muslim community, after having met, decided that FBI is after us. And therefore, we should not talk to them. That action in itself gives you a sense how the gap is getting bigger. And because of that, what it boils down to, we have lost the war on the ideology. You know, this has always been a war on the minds and the hearts of the masses. And we miserably lost that. You know, sitting in somewhere in Minneapolis, someone walking into my office with a petition telling me, oh, let's sign this petition not to coordinate with the FBI agents. Okay. Because of that, because of disassociation or lack of understanding the institutions of this country, the minority of those with the view of radicalism were able to mobilize and create a perception, a negative of this country, where then it became easier for them to indoctrinate young kids. The kids that are very vulnerable, suffering from identity crisis, cultural barrier, language difficulties, you know, without interrogation, assimilation going on, they became very, very vulnerable. Not only that, but by feeding them with the information that, gee, this country, as it is, United States, exists and embodies the personification of destruction of the Muslim community. You know, the existence of it is to destroy us. So that, because kids became vulnerable, they dig mosques, colleges, universities, what have you, from the streets. Some of the kids were gangs, get lost in the system, gangs, and then they will be given a born again life as a Muslim fanatics. And it was a sheer luck, to answer your question, not because of a level of sophistication, but pure luck that the Somalian guy somewhat decided to blow himself up in Somalia rather than in downtown Minneapolis.
Yes, sir. Good question. Go ahead.
Hi, Ava Lozman from the Voice of America Somali Service. I have two questions. Now, given the fact that there's lack of experience in terms of the members of the Somali government, since it's based on the 4.5 clan system, rather than recruiting people based on their experience, how do you foresee them being able to, you know, put into function the pledge that they were given in Brussels in terms of restoring security on the grounds in Somalia. And my second question is, how do you see the ex-warlords, like in that other joint forces with the government recently, can have an impact again on restoring the security of the on the streets of the district?
The idea of basing a distribution of power on 4.5 defeats the purpose. It's not going to work. Period. You don't get entitlement of access to institution by being member of certain clan. You have to have equality. There has to be quality control. You have to be qualified in order to hold a public office. Not that because you have to be a member of X clan that you're automatically entitled. That's not the way it works. And because of the basic assumption of that process in itself is a destruction of it. And it's very sad. And those who are there in Mogadishu City, and those even before them, I think international community knows that it's not going to work. It's very obvious.
So why do you think the UN still decided to give more than $200 million?
Again, UN and NGOs... I think UN needs to get reformed, becoming an old institution. The world's changing so fast. We're facing a new dilemma. The world is getting into right now is not unlike the conventional war in the past. I think UN NGOs, some of them have been part of the Somali internal civil war by money, lots of money. Nobody knows where it went. What happened to that money? It's not reaching the needy. No service is getting delivered. Where the money is going? We don't know. They have a meeting in Brussels, and they say, we give you a couple of $1 million, and nothing gets done because there is no system of accountability in place. And as far as the warlords shifting alliances, that has been the history of that country, and it will be, sadly, for the future, for foreseeable future. They always change horses. But they don't go nowhere, you know. So that's not, they're here, you know. Funny story I heard, I was reading in Washington Post one time, I was laughing, you know. It's funny because U.S. military generalists of Afghanistan gained the confidence of the Afghan warlords by giving them Viagra. Yes. So these warlords, you know, Inade was here yesterday and is there. So I don't put much of interpretation on that.
Well, Omar, on that erotic note, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Dennis Shannon from CBS. I have a question about these recruiters that you're talking about that get the kids. Where do they get the money, and who pays for the tickets? And in Minneapolis and Chicago, and who gives them the ideology? And is it the same group that does it in the UK and in Canada, or different groups? Or how does that? How do you see that?
There is, by the way, an open investigation right now by the FBI in D.C. and I believe in Minneapolis on this question. And I'll tell you this. I do not exactly know. If I did, I would have turned them in, of course. But one thing I know is the people with radical views and extremists, however small they are here, but they're making the most of the noises, and they're taking over the country right now, are the guys with lots of money. They've got money from individuals in Saudi Arabia. Muammar al-Gaddafi, Libya, just gives them a check. You have millions of rich, wealthy individuals in Middle East with the same line of their thinking and have billions of dollars sitting in their account. So they do fundraising. They do fundraising in Minneapolis. And
who's they, though? That's what I'm
They meaning the groups organized, running mosques, spreading an ideology that they think fits to take care of the Somali crisis. We don't have names of individuals, but we know as an entity, they are active here and they're more active in Somalia. No, I think in Minneapolis you have 20 kids left. In Seattle you have 3, I mean 2. St. Cloud, one guy left from St. Cloud. You have here and there people left from UK, England, people left from Australia.
You're talking about people who've actually been kidnapped.
And not kidnapped. No, no. No.
Recruited.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, you're right. That's, you know, for the lack of a better word, not being kidnapped. It is a process of persuasion. It's a process of person becoming convinced that he or she is a part of a bigger, a noble mission. You know, this country one time was locked in war against the evil empire of Soviet Union, gone. Now, as Muslims, as they would like us to believe, is we are with war with an evil, lasting, standing empire, which is United States. Washington to us, as they would like us to believe, is the city of Rome, of a Roman Empire in Italy. So that is, they not kidnap them. They persuade them, they wire them up with their ideas, by feeding their egos, making them a little bit disillusional and bigger, noble, and then therefore they would be able to do whatever they are asked to do. So that's, I think, the reason.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Shukriya Bini. I'm a PhD candidate. I'm a Somali Canadian. I'm very interested in this topic. Mr. Jamali, in your presentation, you seem to project that you know a lot of information about the recruiters. But you kind of deviate. For example, the last points that you made, you said these individuals have tons of money, millions of dollars in their bank account, they do fundraising, they get checks for Muammar Gaddafi. Can you be a little bit specific? Can you tell us? Because you seem to know where they're getting their revenues and their resources, and obviously you know these individuals, so why don't you tell us? Because you can't say...
I think it would be completely unfair to an ongoing investigation process to name someone. I would give, like I said in Minneapolis, let the investigation take its course. I would ask the community, if they have information about this, not to be afraid of the FBI. You can talk to them. You can give them information. We encourage them to collaborate with the agencies that are working on this investigation. We do that, but we cannot name, someone must purchase those guys a ticket, okay? Someone must arrange them hotels to travel. There must be some money involved here. Most of those guys, we know their parents were broke. They didn't have a penny. Where did the money came from? Okay, if you need money to support a war, the war in Mogadishu today, where the government is openly saying that Al-Qaeda is fighting in Mogadishu, you need money to support that. I don't know if you don't think that there's Al-Qaeda fighting in Mogadishu now, because the president of TFG is saying that. And those kids left in Minneapolis now are fighting in the front line of the Somali Mogadishu capital fighting. They're there now. Kids left from UK in Birmingham, in London, are fighting in the front of the Al-Shabaab in Mogadishu City now. Where all this manpower and money coming from? That's a question needs to be answered.
Mr. Jamal, you know too well that despite the conflict or despite the economic marginalization of the Somali diaspora, parents have sent their kids whether at a young age or teenager, back to Somalia so that they could learn the language and the religion. There's nothing wrong with that. Let me finish. But for you to tell me that, and just these parents, you know too well.
No. I did not, on the record, I never said that, however sometimes it's strange it might sound, for Somali parents to send their kids back to Somalia, it happens. You have Somali young men going back to visit their dying fathers, their wives, their kids, yes. I agree with you 100%. Is that a crime? No. But for you to go and join Al-Shabaab or Al-Qaeda and fight and come back, that's a crime. So what I'm telling you is, let's not confuse the issue here. We have, for fact, Somali young victims indoctrinated with whom we sit down with their mothers. Okay? I sit down with their mothers, and by the way, they did not collect the money and send their kids. The kids left without even the mother knowing anything about it. Okay, the mother didn't have nothing to do with this. So we have kids indoctrinated, recruited, sent back, and used them as missiles to accomplish a political goal. So that's a crime. The fact that some people go back, definitely, they do go back, and then came back. That's not a crime.
Omar, we're going to have to stop because we were over our time on the room. Yeah. Now we can continue this later if you want to, but we're going to have to give up the room. Yeah. But anyway, thank you for coming. And if you haven't added your name to the
thank you.
Sheet outside, please do.